KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. When filmmaker Gurinder Chadha set out to make a movie based on journalist Safra Manzoor's coming-of-age memoir about the profound effect of Bruce Springsteen music on his life, she had one small problem. The movie couldn't work without Springsteen's songs. So when she and Manzoor snagged a moment with the boss on a red carpet, she took her shot.
My heart was pumping 10 to the dozen. And I was like, this is it. This is your moment. What are you going to say? Act cool. Be professional, you know. And in the end, I was like, hi, Bruce. My name's Gurinder Chadha. I'm a friend of mine, Becca. Please help us. We want to make a movie and the book. Can you help us? We need your support. So it sort of came out a bit like that, sadly.
But it worked. Chadha and Manzoor tell the tale of the new film, Blinded by the Light, which features no fewer than 19 Springsteen songs. Chadha also tells us how Brexit influenced her decision to make the movie and shares the excitement of the Sundance bidding war. At $15 million, Blinded by the Light was the priciest buy of this year's festival. But first on the news banter, Disney feels some indigestion. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Disney announced its earnings. A little bit of disappointment there. The stock took a ding because, largely, not exclusively, these Fox movies, when they bought Fox, they had some movies in the pipeline, some of them very expensive, notably that X-Men movie, Dark Phoenix, did not perform at all well. So Bob Iger, the chairman of Disney, kind of said, look, we've got this great new stuff from Fox. You know, we have Avatar, Planet of the Apes, Deadpool, and the X-Men, and we are redefining these movies. But in the interim, those movies are not doing well. I think if you're part of the only surviving member of the Fox team going over to Disney, which is Emma Watts, you got to feel a little funny about this, even though Iger tried to say, you know, let's not blame people. It was really distracting. There was a lot of merger talk. But nonetheless, I mean, it's just not ideal because in real terms, it's not like he's even just blaming the Fox movies. The Fox movies didn't perform.
Right. And this is in Iger's interest. I mean, they had a big earnings miss. He needs to explain that to shareholders. So this is the first quarter where the Fox assets are part of their earnings. And Fox had some duds. I mean, if you look at Dark Phoenix, that's a really expensive movie. It did $65 million domestic, $250 worldwide. That is not enough for an X-Men movie.
Not even close.
And he now has to walk this line because for the next few years, at least, the Disney earnings are likely going to be dragged down by this integration of Fox and, more importantly, by the buildup of the Disney streaming service, Disney Plus, which is going live this fall. And Disney Plus is an incredibly important endeavor for the Walt Disney Company. This is the future. They have a Netflix competitor that they're trying to build up worldwide, and that's going to require them to spend like nobody's business to get original content. And they're already doing that with a Star Wars series and a Marvel series and a bunch of other direct-to-consumer video projects. That's going to bring down earnings. Iger says the board is on board with it and they know, but the stock still took a hit when they announced the earnings this time.
Yeah, the idea is, you know, short to medium term pain, long term gain. And one of the analysts I read said the fact that the stock didn't dip more is a sign of the great confidence that people have in what is really truly the Disney juggernaut. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to watch what happens with Disney, what happens with the competition, especially Netflix, but it will take a while to play out.
And let's not go overboard here. The Walt Disney Company is doing fine. They have $4 billion grossers at the box office this year, and it's only August. They still have Frozen and Star Wars sequels coming up. But this is Iger taking the hit now for the benefit strategically down the line.
Also taking a hit, but a bigger one potentially, would be Annapurna. And Annapurna is Megan Ellison's company. I'm sure she's tired of hearing people say that her father is multi-billionaire Larry Ellison, but it's relevant because she and her brother David have been able to establish themselves in Hollywood, David doing more commercial mainstream movies, and Megan Ellison has really been a patron of independent film. The problem is, first of all, some of the movies haven't really worked. Vice wasn't a huge hit. The Sisters Brothers, some of these movies just didn't work. But some people also feel, you know, it's been overly ambitious that she tried to expand into distribution, which was a very ambitious thing to do, especially when you're in a world right now where movies are having a very hard time, unless they are the aforementioned Disney movies, mostly. They just had a problem with Booksmart, which was the Olivia Wilde comedy that just didn't work. And a lot of people thought it was going to be a hit. But this marketplace, especially, I think, for comedies, there's a Netflix effect where people see a film like that and think, well, I'll just wait and stream it at home. I don't need to go to the theater. So going into distribution now, I think, has caused problems. And we are told that they are exploring bankruptcy, although I'm skeptical that they will actually ultimately file for bankruptcy.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, I do think they will refinance, they will pivot, they will do what they need to do to stay in business. But the upshot here is it seems like Larry Ellison is likely going to take more of an interest and more of an oversight of what she's doing. And that could lead to fewer of the big swings like the Vices or the Detroits or the movies that cost a lot and don't have much potential upside in the current film market.
Yes, I think maybe the bankruptcy talk there is just trying to get people who are creditors to back off a little bit. I'm not sure. Let me just also say that Universal has its hands full with a movie from Blumhouse. It's called The Hunt. This thing was a controversial idea months ago before it became a movie, because the plot line is a bunch of red state types wake up on an estate. They've been kidnapped and they're being hunted by elites. And we broke a story recently about how ESPN had pulled an ad in the wake of the tragedies in El Paso and Dayton, because this is a very violent movie. And of course, the theme of political divisiveness, I'm sure, doesn't necessarily help. We were told, and Universal subsequently confirmed, that they're going to be holding ads. The movie is supposed to open late September. I don't know if it will. I mean, now, and I don't approve of this, I want to be really clear, people are judging it having not seen it. And when I say people, I mean primarily people on the right-wing media taking this opportunity to pulverize Hollywood. Now, I don't know if this movie was a good idea. I don't think it looks like my cup of tea because it looks extremely violent, but it is supposed to be a satire. I don't think Universal took the opportunity with this story to explain very well what the movie is supposed to be, but now they have a problem on their hands. It's not super expensive, but it's a problem.
Universal knew that this movie was potentially explosive. There was, as you reported, some misgivings internally about whether they should even tackle it in the first place. Now, they seem to have been leaning in. They were running ads during the Democratic debate, you know, trying to lure a politically oriented audience into this kind of violent horror thriller. But now it's a real problem. And I would not be surprised if the release date of this film is pushed, especially if there continue to be violent attacks in this country.
Certainly, let's hope that the violence will subside at this point, because we've had so much more than enough. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In the new coming-of-age movie, Blinded by the Light, newcomer Vivek Kalra plays Javed, a lonely and repressed teenager dealing with tough financial times and anti-Muslim sentiment in the British town of Luton. It's 1987, and Luton has been hit hard by Thatcher-era austerity. Javed fancies himself a writer, but his father, a Pakistani immigrant played by Kulvinder Gear, emphatically rejects that idea.
I want to be a writer, but my family is stuck in another century.
Writing isn't a job. I need you to do more.
The world changes for Javed when his Sikh classmate, played by Aaron Fagora, slips him two Bruce Springsteen cassette tapes. Remember cassette tapes?
Bruce, the direct line to all that's true in this world. Seriously? What does he know about our world? Guard these with your life, yeah? You can thank me later.
Javed's doubts about Springsteen vanish as he hits play, and he is soon transformed by music and lyrics that seem to speak directly to him, a world away from Asbury Park. Blinded by the Light is based on the life of journalist Safraz Manzoor, who chronicled his grand Springsteen awakening in a 2007 memoir. He recently joined us in the studio, along with director Gurinder Chadha, whose films include Bride and Prejudice, but whose greatest hit so far remains 2002's Bend It Like Beckham. I just saw you getting fangirled in the KCRW offices about
yes.
Bend It Like, and I'm guessing just where you go
yes.
when people hear that.
A lot of selfies.
A lot of selfies.
But it's wonderful to have made a film that touched so many people. And still 17 years later, as a filmmaker, that's incredibly gratifying.
Yes, and it was a lot of firsts, I think, you know.
Yeah, business-wise, it was the highest grossing independent British film at the time.
Yes. Yeah. What followed? What was the impact on you of having made this record-breaking film?
Well, career-wise, yeah, for the first time in my life, I was able to buy myself a house.
That's nice.
Which was very nice. Mm-hmm. With Bargee on the Beach, my previous film, I actually bought my parents a bungalow, like a good Indian
good
daughter.
Good Indian daughter that you are, yeah.
So this time I bought myself a flat. But obviously, it had a great commercial impact. And I think it showed the world that you could make films that made money with people of colour in them and women. But the shocking thing for me is that 17 years later, there hasn't been another film like that. Not for want of people trying, I'm sure. And I think the way the marketing, branding and selling of movies goes, there is this perception that it doesn't make good business sense to put people of colour in movies because people who are not of that background won't be interested in seeing them. And I'm absolutely so happy and relieved that Black Panther changed that for good. So that was a real game changer, and also Crazy Rich Asians. These are big game changers in the US, I think. And hopefully Blinded by the Light will take that mantle from Bender Like Bing being my most popular film to a new one.
Right, right.
And I think the thing with Blinded by Light is that it's not doing these things in a kind of an explicit, we're going to do this in a nutritional way because you should like diversity. It just happens that the characters are what they are, but the story is bigger than that. And we don't really ram anything down anyone's throat in terms of that.
No, we never do. I mean, the whole point for me as a filmmaker is to make movies that are about characters that you relate to, regardless of who you are and where you come from.
Well, as simple as it may sound, there's actually so much going on in the film in terms of family relationships. You know, I think it's very universal for children of immigrants from wherever they are. And then you're dealing with racial relationships. It's a lot going on in the film. But let me get into how you made the film. Where did you two, first of all, meet?
So we met ages and ages ago. So I had been a big fan of Springsteen since I was at school. But Safraz was a journalist, and I read an article where he'd actually interviewed Bruce Springsteen, and then he had this funny picture of him standing there with Bruce in the back, as if he'd sort of caught him unawares. And I saw that picture. I was like, oh my God, there's another Asian person that likes Bruce Springsteen in Britain. How weird is that? And then, of course, we met, and I thought, well, actually, here's a man who's very obsessed about Bruce Springsteen. And we sort of really bonded about
I mean, did
that.
You call him up and just say, hi, I'm another...
I think we just ran into, because, you know, there aren't... In terms of the media world, you know, I would get invited to various sort of things and you'd get invited. And I remember, I think it was like a BAFTA event, actually, and I obviously knew your work and I knew off you. And I think somehow we started to talk about Springsteen. And I remember you mentioned that you like The Ghost of Tom Joad, the album, which is not sort of an album that somebody who's not a proper fan would cite. And I was like, oh my God, she isn't just say born in the USA. She knows what she's talking about. And I think that sort of, you know, just to be honest, also, if you're a Springsteen fan, you know, you like talking about him to people.
Exactly.
Anyway.
And it's so interesting because we never actually used to talk about our Asianness or our work. We only ever used to talk about Springsteen.
Yeah.
So then when does the idea of making this a film? You wrote a book.
I wrote a book, Greetings from Berry Park, and that got published in 2007. I think I might have sent her chapters as I was writing it, because it felt like in a sort of a dream world, it had the possibility of maybe making a film. And obviously I knew nothing about that world, but because I knew Gurinder, I just thought, well, having, you know, had the success of Bend It Like Beckham, also being a Springsteen fan, also being kind of culturally from the same heritage, it's like a moonshot, as in there's only one person who can do this. And so I sent it to her, and, you know, we talked about it at that point, and then you basically said, this is all very well and fine and dandy, but the only way we're going to be able to do this is if Springsteen likes what we do, because we can't do it without his approval. And that was quite a big hurdle to be thinking about.
I think we
needed the music.
Maybe if some bottomless pockets had opened up, that never...
But he wouldn't... I don't think he doesn't need the money. So
he
it wouldn't
doesn't.
Even just be about
right.
that.
So how did that work?
So in 2010, Bruce came to London for his movie, The Promise. It was the premiere. Right. I got invited. I ditched my husband and took Safraz, as he says very wisely.
Yes.
And we were both standing on the red carpet.
This was a plot, just to be clear.
Well, this was fandom, actually. Uh-huh. At this point, we were just like, oh my God,
it was
Bruce
the next best
coming.
Thing to going to a gig, wasn't it? He wasn't touring, but he was going to be in the room.
He was in the room. We stood opposite each other on the carpet. And as Bruce came round the corner, a miracle happened.
So I'd written the book and I'd got the book with me, hoping to give it to him, having no idea whether he even knew it existed. And there was a lot of people flurrying around, but then somehow he caught my eye and he saw me and he walked over and he just told me, I really loved your book.
And they were like, oh, excuse me, I must die because my life is complete.
Kind of, yeah, kind of.
And he recognised Safraz because, of course, he'd been to hundreds of gigs and was always in the front row. And Safraz is a very tall, skinny Pakistani with an afro.
Yeah,
and there are not many people that look like that who go to Bruce concerts. So while Safraz and Bruce were sort of chatting about the book, I say chatting, it was more like hyperventilating kind of conversation.
I was
going to
say, was your heart like a chunka chunka chunka?
It's a one-sided hyperventilating. He seemed quite relaxed about it all.
He was like, you said, how did you get it? And he went, oh, people send me things, like very casual. And meanwhile, my heart was pumping 10 to the dozen. And I was like, this is it. This is your moment. What are you going to say? Act cool, be professional, you know? And in the end, I was like, hi, Bruce. My name's Corinda Chatter. I'm in Bed and I'm Becky. Please help us. We want to make a movie of the book. Can you help us? We need your support. So it sort of came out a bit like that, sadly. And he kind of looked at us both. And then he went, sounds good. Talk to John. And John Landau, his manager, was behind him. And we then talked to John. And
on the spot, because otherwise talk to John could be like call a number for a person who will never...
This movie, next to him.
Yes. Yeah, this movie's destiny all happened in the space of 2 minutes on that red carpet. Because we exchanged details with Tracy Nurse, who was one of his managers from Sony. And we said, well, what happens now? And Tracy said, well, he likes the idea. You should write the script. And of course, that's what we then proceeded to do.
And the whole idea when we were writing it was, is Bruce going to like it?
That was
the North Star. Right. I remember you saying, yes, it's got development money from the British Film Institute, and yes, but actually those people don't matter as much as the one person who has to like this.
Exactly.
I just wonder for a moment when you were on that red carpet and he encounters you, you know, do you see him thinking, interesting artistic people or stalkers? You seem a little unsure.
I think he probably thought Safraz was a stalker. Because he read the book.
He was very sweet. Yeah.
Right? He read the book. That's the important element.
He knew the world.
Okay.
And he knew that Safraz was a very authentic, honest supporter with integrity.
Right.
A
real person.
Because he'd seen him in Pittsburgh and Sweden and all these other countries.
Thing that was interesting about it was I had been, you know, I wouldn't use the word stalker. I think that's possibly libelous.
A little pejorative.
But I had been persistent. Shall we say persistent? In terms of just being around. But what was amazing about that moment was that I think he was able, or I hope he was able, to sort of put me from that obsessive fan box into a writer.
Yes,
box.
Exactly. Right. And he had heard of Bend It Like Beckham. He had been touring Australia when it came out.
Oh, my.
And it was a big hit in Australia. And his kids were quite young and they'd gone to see it. And somehow I had heard that, you
all
know,
the good associations
it
came
all
together.
Came together.
Yeah.
And I think it was the integrity of the fact that he knew Safraz as a pure fan that made him think twice. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know. He might have thought, Jesus, I'm going to get away from these guys. Yeah. But actually, he didn't. And the next day, John Landau was photographed going into the hotel with a copy of Safraz's book in his pocket. So that's when we were like, oh my God, this is serious now.
Coming up after a short break, Corinda Chadha tells us about the nerve-wracking experience of screening her Bruce Springsteen movie for Bruce Springsteen. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Gurinder Chadha and writer and Bruce Springsteen superfan Safraz Manzoor, whose coming-of-age memoir is the inspiration for the new movie Blinded by the Light. In the film, Vivek Kalra plays Javed, a 16-year-old Muslim kid growing up in an economically depressed town in the Britain of 1987. Lonely and broke and dealing with the town's prejudice, Javed is shocked to discover how strongly he connects to the music of a man more than two decades his senior who grew up in the far-off land of New Jersey.
I listened to everything, both tapes. I'm telling you, I can feel it all right here. It's like Bruce knows everything I've ever felt, everything I've ever wanted.
Inspired by Springsteen's music and lyrics, Javed gains the confidence to pursue his dream of becoming a writer. He's also emboldened to stand up to racist bullies and even go after the girl. But his stern father, played by Kulvinder Gill, disapproves of Springsteen's influence.
Do you think that this man sings for people like us?
But he talks to me.
For director Gurinder Chadha, making Blinded by the Light wasn't going to be possible without getting the rights to use Springsteen's music. No small task. And even after she and Manzoor managed to secure Bruce's blessing, Chadha said the movie still almost didn't happen.
During the process of writing, which of course takes a long time, I went off and made another film, Viceroy's House. And then coming back from that, I was deciding what film to make next because I didn't want to repeat myself with this film because it was similar to Bend It Like Beckham in some ways. But I do love Bruce Springsteen, so I was kind of torn what to do. And then Brexit happened in England. Mm. And that was a very shocking moment for us. And for me, I just saw society being broken down because of xenophobia. And that's when I said, right, I need to pick up this script, I need to go through it, and I need to channel all my anger and frustration and put it into this project as a timely reminder of what we both went through in the 80s and that we don't want to go back there.
But also with hope.
But also with hope, because our lives aren't just defined by race and racists. You know, that's a very important point.
The other thing that's really interesting, actually, is the reaction that we've had since it's been shown in even previous screenings. So a couple of days ago, it was being played in LA, and a guy came up to me, possibly in his mid-20s, white guy, baseball cap, and he said, I've never connected to a story as much as I've connected to this.
Mm.
And I find that mind-blowing. You know, he's obviously not Pakistani, he's obviously not Muslim, he's obviously not from Luton, but the central ideas about how do you follow your dreams without completely destroying your relationship with your parents, how do you try and get a life that's bigger than the one you grew up with, he totally connected with it in a way that he'd apparently never connected with any other film. And I just thought, you know, that's an incredible achievement for everybody involved to have made something which is bigger than the story that it originally comes from.
There are 17, I think, Springsteen songs.
19.
19. Every time I read a number, it's gone up. Did you have free reign and you got to pick?
Yes.
Did you get into Springsteen fights because you wanted the one and some friends wanted the other?
No. You know, I had carte blanche to use anything, but I didn't want to do a jukebox musical. And it was important that every song had we used it with integrity. And there were scenarios, you know, I was like, what should I do here? And I would call Safraz and he'd be on a bus or something. And I'd say, here's a scenario. What do you think? Which song? And he would say, give me half an hour. And then within 2 minutes, he'd call back and go, so the third verse of this song, it says, what do you think? You know, it was a great nuts and bolts analysis.
Right, you had
analysis.
Your human computer here.
But it was about emotionally telling a story, wasn't it? It wasn't just about, you know, let's just try and crowbar this song
in. No, I get that.
And also, because the film is set in 1987, it was only going to be the back catalogue up to 1987 because it wouldn't make sense.
Purity.
So there were some limits on what you could, you know, what you could play.
Well, you have to go and screen the movie for him at some point.
So we sent him the script. He had read it. Word came back. He said, I'm all good with this. That was his sentence.
We're like, what? No notes?
And we were like, yeah, exactly. No notes. So I was like, well, he has to have some opinions.
Right.
And Tracy said, no. He said, I'm all good with this. You should go and make your movie.
Let me say it again. I'm all good with this.
Yeah, because I couldn't believe that, you know, it was that simple, to be honest with you. But that's then what we did. I made the movie, came back, had a director's cut. And he didn't ask to see anything. I was the one who said, I really got to show it to him because I'm carrying this burden of responsibility here. And I went to New York, sat in a little screening room on a Sunday afternoon, yeah, because he was on Broadway. And then we screened the movie and he watched it very intensely and smiled a lot and laughed at things. And then at the very end, there was silence. Nobody said anything. His managers were in the room too. And of course, no one wanted to say anything until Bruce spoke. So I went down and put the lights on, not knowing what anyone was thinking. And then he got up and he walked over and he gave me a big kiss on my cheek. And then he put his arms around me and he said, "Wow, thank you for looking after me so beautifully. Don't change a thing. I love it."
And again, life could have ended that day and be a rich, full life.
Yes.
So you go to Sundance at the Eccles, the big theater.
Yeah.
People were...
That was the first time we were seeing the film with an audience because it literally had just been finished.
It was dripping wet.
Dripping wet in the Eccles. 1,800 people, all Americans mainly, I think, you know. So we were like, well, this is going to be interesting, watching this film set in Luton about this six-year-old Pakistani kid with all these Americans who are all coming here because half of them are Bruce fans.
Yeah,
so we were like, they're going to go, what the heck is this, yes, you know? And I walked on stage to introduce the film and all these people went, Bruce. So I was like, oh, my God, they're going to think, what have we done to the boss? Like, we had no idea. And of course, the movie played so well. There were certain moments where I thought the roof was going to come off that theater, the way people cheered and hollered. It was a very...
And you let us sing along?
Yes. I was mercilessly playing to the crowd. I made sure everyone sang Hungry Heart just to get us in the mood. But it was a, you know, these are the moments where people say, your life is about to change. In moments like that. And Safras's life has irrevocably changed.
I was thinking about what is the metric of success, you know? And just to have a film made is a success,
absolutely,
considering how hard it is, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I remember you calling me and saying, oh, it's been accepted by Sundance. I thought, well, that's a success, you know?
Right.
And then they said it's going to be screened in the biggest cinema in Sundance. And I genuinely was thinking, they're going to have to get some really large black curtains to kind of cover up the fact that it's going to be mostly empty. Why are all these people going to go and see a film about a kid in Luton in 1987? And so then to get the kind of reaction that we did, and personally for me, it wasn't even the standing ovation and everything. It was when we got to the after show party and you started seeing tweets from people who had left watching the film and saying things like, the most joyous thing I've seen this year, the feel good. And these weren't critics even at this point. This was just people who were seeing it. And I was like, this is really connected. Something special is happening.
Right.
And that has carried on right through to now.
Now, you had a bidding contest there.
Yes.
I was kind of surprised, honestly, to see the Warner's logo because I just don't think of them necessarily out there. But the music probably was a big hook for them.
Well, I think... You know, to give a little bit of context, of course, because there was a lot of love in the room because of Bend It Like Beckham. So I had proved that I could make a hit movie. And so I think for distributors, they had that to fall back on, if you like. But yes, we had a great bidding war. In fact, it actually started just like 20 minutes into the movie. In fact, Carolyn Blackwood from New Line, from Warner Brothers, actually texted.
Yes, I don't think she tweeted.
Endeavor, no, to say, I'm going to buy this movie. Don't let anyone else buy it. And then the bidding started and lots of distributors were in the room. And it started at, you know, like 7 million and then went to 10 million very fast and 12. So it was slightly nerve-wracking. But then Carolyn came in and she just said, I really don't need this movie. I want this movie. You know, you think this is an independent movie. It's not. This is a movie that needs to be seen in every theater across America right now. And that was her pitch, you know, and I feel that Warner Brothers are really getting behind it in an amazing way. And I just hope that the audience shows up.
Okay, so we're going to go out on a Springsteen song.
What are you going to end with?
Well, that's what we're asking you to choose.
Oh, you want to ask a song. Choose a song.
Yeah, choose a song for us to come out of the show.
What are we going to do? Hold on, we've got to agree.
Why don't we end with the song that the film ends with? Born to Run.
Gurinder Chadha is the director of Blinded by the Light, inspired by the life of Safras Manzoor. Thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance this week from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.